Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Harbor and Sprout podcast. We are so excited today to be speaking with Nick Slavik. Nick is the proprietor of Nick Slavik Painting and Restoration Company. I have known Nick's family for many years now, and following along with them and with his work, the thing that you see the most is that these are just absolute salt of the earth people. Quality, kindness, great values, no corners cut. And so I wanted to bring Nick on and talk to him about painting science and about restoration and about all that he does, because you see a painter and they're putting on paint, but there is so much more to the story than that. And the business that he runs is just, it's incredible to witness from afar. So Nick, thank you so much for being willing to come talk to us today and tell us a bit more about what you do.
No, absolutely. This is awesome to do. And my wife, myself, and my family are big fans of you and what you do as well. So the feeling is mutual.
Oh, thank you. Well, let's go ahead and just get started. So how did you get started with painting and restoration?
Yeah, there's kind of only two origin stories for painters and master craftspeople like myself. You either did it in college and came back to it, or your dad made you do it. And my dad owned a painting company before me, and he did it in college and he came back to it. He was an English major, journalism major, couldn't find his way in the newspaper world. So he went back to painting. And then I encompassed the other origin story. My father made me do it, and he started me when I was 10 years old. So much like we do for our families, we throw a hand in. Mom was in there, brother was in there, I was in there. And yeah, from 10 years old, I was kind of an indentured servant to the family business.
Oh, I love it. So you already had a lot of skill going into your further education. Is it something that you really enjoyed as a child?
This is hilarious. So between 10 and 18, when I was forced to do it, I didn't really enjoy it that much, you know, just like anything else. I left for a couple years after that for the military. And then I really gained an appreciation for like the freedom to choose to do it. And when I chose to do it, it just like blossomed for me. You know, that's funny how the human condition works. Like, this is a thing that I love deeply, but when somebody makes you do it, you think about it differently. And after I could choose to do it, it really is my life's passion. I love this.
Your passion for what you do and the team that you lead, the people, really shows through in all that I see that you're doing. So that, I believe that for sure. So yes, you paint, but what else does your line of work entail in restoration work and in your leadership as well as the owner?
Yeah. So this is probably not unique to my business, but the thing that we traffic in, so that we can charge people money, so that we can run a business, so that we can do other things, is painting. And painting is actually the easiest part about what we do. You keyed into just previously the most important part, which is developing humans, which obviously it sounds like you're a fan and you practice that in your everyday life. And you slowly realize, like, it doesn't matter if you're an auto mechanic, if you're a homeschooler, if you're a house painter, you win with people. And your ability to not only be a technician and know the painting side, be a manager, like just have people do tasks with and around you, but then like elevate that to being a leader. That is people's ability to work through those and be effective at those largely is a great indicator of success. So yes, we paint, right? And painting is the vehicle in which we review our people and which we allow us to create economic benefit for people. But we are a leadership training academy and we are a human development academy that happens to paint. And probably not news to you, but this is basically, I was in this industry for 25 years before I realized this. And only in the last 6-7 years have I really got serious about, oh, wait a second, like we're going to be a real business. We're going to be professional. And you only do that with developing humans.
That's a great place to place your energy in developing more people, raising them up to rise to the occasion and become who you can see that they can be. What is in the training process to become a painter? I guess for you, it was kind of, you were immersed in it all the way through. But when you take these high school classes that you teach painting, how do you start, or how do you get point A to point B?
Yeah, this is this is like an experiment in the human condition, right? So I was forced to, I was grabbed by the back of my neck and basically just told, you're going to do this, and, you know, honor the family. So I did. And now, not only in running a real business, but when working with millennials or Gen Z, that is not a winning strategy anymore by screaming and yelling and force of will. So you really need to understand, like, you need to inspire people to do this stuff. So my training program is, it starts with, it's this crazy holistic system. It starts with a job ad that doesn't look like any other job ad. So the typical painting ad right now, if you're just to pull up Indeed or something, it would say, must lift 50 pounds, must have driver license, must not be lazy, pay based on experience. It's like the most uninspiring vanilla ad ever. And magically, you're not going to get much response. So we do things like, we have an artful image and we say things like, we're looking for decent human beings. You make the cut, your family. We'll break ourselves to train you. I'll treat you like you work the rest of your life with me. You'll have opportunities here like you'll never have elsewhere. Once that dog whistles to a certain type of people that we like to actually hang around with, then we bring them in for a one-year apprenticeship. It starts with 1 to 2 weeks in our training facility where we actually bring people in, let them feel the culture of the business, train them on the technical stuff, on our standard operating procedures. We bring our senior most people in to let them kind of just like the culture infuse through them so they can live our core values. And then we assign them a mentor. And 4 times a year, we have goal setting and review meetings where we have certain gates that they need to accomplish. And everything is metric based. It's a light switch. They either accomplished it or they didn't, with an immense amount of human development, coaching, training, mentoring, things like that. So at the end of 1 year, we want people to be a leader. We want them to lead their own crew, teach somebody else the way that we taught them. So it's kind of like the force multiplier effect where we're creating branches on a tree where it's not good enough for you to come here and just be a painter. That's fine if that's all you want. But what we're really looking for is creating the next leader so they can create the next apprentice to become a leader too.
And you developed this program, didn't you? This mentorship apprenticeship program?
Yeah. So this is, we are actually known for this. This creates a lot of waves in the trades across the US because this is an empathetic, thoughtful, connected, sub 30, 40 year old way of going about the trades. And the way I was raised in the trades is old grumpy men scream at you to do it better and do it faster. And again, like I said, not a winning strategy anymore. You'll actually repulse people and then create a bad brand for yourself. So initially, when I started my company 15 years ago, I just put that same ad out there and I got grumpy painters coming to work for a grumpy painting company. And I led the way that my father did, which is, come on, let's do this faster, better. Nothing written down, no empathy, no anything else. And I soon realized you can't grow a business that way. And it's not the culture I want. So we said, you know what? There's only one way. We operate with the decent human being theory, which is we are only going to look for people who have never done this before, but people that share our core values, bring them in. And then, like I said before, painting is the easy part. We cannot teach core values as highly as we think of ourselves. Like, you can teach your kid core values as an educator. I can't take somebody who's in their mid 20s and make them have core values that they didn't before. So we basically have to throw a cast net out, find the decent humans, and then inspire them to love this craft like I do.
The decent human being theory. I like that. I think I could carry over into many areas of life. And everything. It just makes so much sense because if you treat people the way that you see they can grow, they're going to rise up to that. They're going to grow into that. And you're giving them that opportunity. And that's a big endeavor and a lot of work on your end. You're not going surface level. You're going way deep with these people and helping them become who they're going to be. People first, painters second. That's cool. I really like that.
And especially when you consider, like, you know, 50% of my leadership team is women and 20 to 26%, depending on seasonally, of my entire workforce of craftspeople are women. They are not historically represented in the trade. So you, as employers, as the next generation of trades business entrepreneurs, we have to understand that if you don't take a look at underrepresented people, even women are 51% of the workforce. If you're a trades company that's not considering bringing women in, you're automatically eliminating 51% of the potential people that you could develop. So now when we bring people in, not only have these people never been in the trades, but you're looking at even women who have not been represented in the trades. So you have to understand, like, there's a lot of stress and there's a lot of, like, they're imagining a situation where grumpy old men are yelling at them. And we have to dispel that myth in the first couple of weeks. And that's why that whole apprenticeship program is here, where we bring them into our facility. We have master craftspeople like me and my people come in. They look like them. They act like them. They share the same core values. And immediately you can see that sword and shield, that defensiveness just be laid down. It is the most beautiful thing to see.
Oh, I love that. To be just embraced that way.
Yeah.
In your workplace and in your training place, knowing that you're growing in many ways, a multitude of ways. So what are your favorite types of restoration projects? You talked about the old Victorian mansions. I think that's where I would gravitate towards. But what's, do you like to go into an old dilapidated place and just make it incredible? Or I think you're old school.
Yes. Right
now. What's your favorite type?
Yeah, so I have an affinity for anything old. And the one thing that gives me hope, you know, because I don't want to turn into some grumpy old man, right? So I feel like I'm middle-aged now, and I always fear that everybody younger than me will lose the love and the affinity for old things, especially when you consider like old growth wood, that's doors and trim and cabinets, trees that will never exist again, that have been handmade, things like that. And I am deeply touched that everybody younger than me that I employ has a deep affinity for old things, old schools, old buildings, old houses, the way that people did it in the past. That gives me a lot of hope. What's cool about that is if you want to inspire a bunch of young people to get into the craft, show them a picture of a Victorian mansion and then say, we get to restore this thing. History, 150 years old, that we're going to be a part of lovingly restoring this. So part about my personality, I gravitate towards the old stuff, but I gravitate towards big stuff. Like for me, restoring one antique brass doorknob is cool, but it's not great. And so that's where we go towards the Victorian mansions, the ones that take 800 labor hours of master craft people time, feats and sizes of buildings that everybody would just be scared to even take on. We can do in 3-4 weeks with my company and my master crafts people. I love doing great things. I love doing big things.
What I'm hearing is that it is of great value to take the time and the effort involved in preserving those old big things properly. There are no shortcuts, and it's not always better to do things the fast and efficient way.
Yeah.
If that means compromising quality or compromising some of the history and some of just the inherent beauty and some of this work that other people have done long ago, it's a lovely thing to keep that alive and to spend the time and the effort to do so, because there's a lot of life within those walls and those doors and that wood still.
I think about that a lot. So like one of the cool innovative things that we do is I'm known as the old house guy around here. So when they're tearing down a church, when they're tearing down a school building or something like that, people call me and they're like, Nick, you take all the valuable stuff out of here because we know you're actually going to use it. You're not going to resell it and other stuff. So I have sheds full. It's like my library, my archive of old trim and doors and cabinets and other things. And when my wife and I actually built that house, that sort of innovative, you know, hydronically heated floor house, all of our doors and trim and cabinets were actually salvaged out of local buildings where the craftspeople wrote their names on the back. There was one historic school building that was attached to a Catholic church where my wife and I actually got married, and the priest signed just about every piece of wood on the backside. So when we put that stuff in our house, we flipped that over and I restored the signatures, and we actually have that on display in a brand new house. And we have big, crazy baseboard. We have antique doors, and I want to inculcate that into my kids and the people that come to my house, which is you can buy expensive new stuff, but you'll never replicate that feeling of something truly valuable, something that has history, you know, human history.
Oh, I love that. I really love that. You can tell that that's something that's important to you, and it should be important. I like that you instill that in other people too, the care of those old things. What kinds of challenges do you face in your work?
Yeah. So limiting beliefs are the biggest challenge I face, both within myself and those around me. And as a passive aggressive, introverted Minnesotan, I am very hard on myself. My wife is very hard on herself. That's a sort of like stoicism that was, imbued into us when we were very young. So I have to keep it in check. But also the biggest problem I have is I really think I love this thing so much. I'm always disappointed that I can't inspire people to greater accomplishments within this trade. Literally of all the last year, one of my craftspeople that we hand trained, he's only been in the trades for 4 years, won Craftsperson of the Year in all of North America. And this is, he's going up against people who have 3-4 decades of experience. So when I say this, we have the greatest people on earth. I love my people to death. I really feel like I'm not doing a good job inspiring my people. You know, as when you go from technician to manager to leader, you're the leader of your family. When you go to leader, you need to rise to, you can't just make them brush their teeth or eat the food. You need to inspire them to do great things. And sometimes I'm really hard on myself about, I feel like I could do a better job of inspiring people. And good and bad, you know, you can't beat up on yourself, but it's also good to never be like, boy, I solved this whole leadership thing. Everything's fine here and we're dandy. So yeah, that's the thing I struggle with the most. It's all people things.
Well, it's interesting to hear you say that because I'm sitting here on my end of things thinking, man, I should like have a coaching call with him every week or something, because I personally as a leader feel so inspired right now just by the way that you talk about what you do and how you lead. And I think this is the kind of person I want to learn from. You are the kind of person that somebody like me would love to learn from.
No, I love this because what you just said is a dog whistle to other people like me. What I found, and this is not giving myself a compliment, but what I found is that the greatest leaders constantly seek out constant improvement, and they seek out that limiting beliefs. And I have 3 coaching and accountability calls with 3 different people like you and like me, that when we get on a call like that, all I'm doing is just like, man, I want to be a better leader. I want to be a better entrepreneur. I want to be a better father and husband and just human.
What is something unexpected for you about painting and restoration, or any fascinating little known tidbits that you just latch onto that nobody else might catch?
Because of the Ask a Painter thing, people come to me with a lot of questions about our trade and entrepreneurship and everything else. And I feel like I give a series of unsatisfying questions. And I usually lead the conversation with, all right, I don't have a hack, right? There's not many hacks in what we do. It's more of like mastering the basics. So it's one of those things where when you consider what is the difference between a bad experience getting your house painted and a bad paint job and true masters, it's disciplining yourself to do 86 separate, tiny, unsexy, mundane, boring tasks really well all the time. Mm-hmm. Like, we have these standard operating procedures and there's 22 steps to painting the walls in the bedroom, like the one you're sitting in. And if one of those steps is not done 100%, your experience will be bad and the paint job will be bad. So the unsatisfying answer is like, the biggest realization for me is like, there's not a secret paint. There's not a secret brush. There's not a secret technique. In my industry, there are no secrets. Literally, you go to Sherwin-Williams, we buy the same gallon of paint that everyone else does, the same brush, and we even buy the same Dickies painter pants. Like, there is no secrets in our trade. It's, can you be disciplined as a human to do the unsexy, mundane, boring things constantly really well? And I honestly don't think that's unique to this. I think it's not unique to homeschooling. I don't think it's unique to running a Fortune 100 company. It's who can master the basics forever.
Oh, that's true. And I think, especially in today's society, people spend so much time thinking, how can I get around doing all these little things that I do not want to do? And you're gonna lose quality if you do that, and you're gonna lose people, and you have to do it. And that's the discipline to do the things is huge.
Well, and even when you consider like young kids, you know, I had a group of high school kids here from a business class. I love these young minds. And I was like, hey guys, who here wants to like grow up and be an influencer and like, you know, be on YouTube making a bunch of money? And, you know, a third of the class raises their hand. And that's a thing that people aspire to. And it's like, you may not know this, and it's hard for me to say this about myself, but literally I'm an influence on the internet. Now, I may have a very weird niche of like master crafts people and trades business entrepreneurs, but even that is not a get rich quick scheme. I've been doing my weekly show for 7 years. And I think I did it over 100 episodes before anybody gave me a nickel to do it. And it's just like that grind, that being disciplined, doing the boring, unsexy things, shooting the show off into the universe for free, talking to yourself for years before anybody takes notice. So even that is not a get rich quick scheme.
Yes, it's a long haul. We've thought this so many times. There's so many efforts and so much work put into it. And it's a slow burn of growth.
It is.
And that's okay, because it's a steady burn of growth and a stable burn of growth.
stable is huge. So the dream, like when we talk about like what we do, I'm assuming freedom is something that we hold very deeply. And freedom for me is like time freedom and money freedom. And we call internally my business a little freedom machine. And it's not just for me and my family. It's for my entire leadership team, my people. I mean, at the baseline, we have a 4-day work week. My people have 50% more weekend than anybody else ever. And that is one of the micro freedoms that we can provide. So I love this sort of thing of this consistent, stable thing that creates freedom for everybody who shares our core values and wants to throw a hand in with us.
Well, and you have full power over the ethics too. So you can be living a life that feels honest and genuine.
Yeah.
You don't have to worry that you're doing anything shady or that you're taking, you know, loopholes that, oh, it'll be fine. Yeah. I mean, you can make sure that everything is the utmost quality and you can sleep at night because of that.
It would be super hard to fake this at this level for 15 straight years.
So it would be
exhausting.
Oh yeah. It would be harder to fake it than to just do it.
Yeah, exactly.
So Ask a Painter Live, is this a podcast or exactly what is it? How can we link that for people here?
Absolutely. So it's a weirdo. It's actually a live Facebook show that I try cast TikTok, Instagram, and Facebook. It all goes live typically every Saturday morning and then gets archived to YouTube eventually. But yeah, it's this weird thing where I literally started it the week that Facebook came out with live. And I really enjoy live off the cuff interactions and question and answers, because there's really not much in my trade that people can answer. So it was a skill I had early. It aligned with live and I just went for it. So every week I broadcast live.
And you stuck with it for a really long time before much came of it. And now it's really grown, hasn't it? I mean, it's a big deal.
It is looked to in the industry as sort of like, you know, I hold a certain bit of objectivity because I'm actually doing this. Like I'm not a consultant and I don't sell anything to people. Mm-hmm. Like when people pop into my show, they're seeing what I'm doing as a business owner, as a master craftsperson and a father of four right now. And it's the most authentic thing because it is just me. This is not a system I'm selling. I don't coach businesses. It's just like, here's what's going on in my business. Here's what's going on in my life. And it's the resource that I would have wanted 15 years ago when I started my business. So it's kind of a guilty pleasure.
Oh, and it doesn't feel like a gimmick at all. It's just the most down-to-earth, honest thing that you could put out there.
It is.
I love that. Okay. Is there anything else that you would like to add or tell us about?
No, that's about it. You hit on all the stuff. I just want to tell you how deeply appreciative of this opportunity like this. I've heard about you for a lot of years. My wife speaks very highly of you and you did not disappoint. So I just want to say thank you.
That is so kind. And we are so grateful to have you come on. I've watched Nick from afar for a really long time and just thought that what you guys all do is so neat. So it's really fun to get to talk to you in person about it all and learn more about what you've got going, because it's about the paint, but it's about a lot more than that. And it's really about the people. And I think that if we can inspire people to know one thing, it's take the time for the people that matters.
It is. And it's maybe the one last thing, the one thing that I would like, especially when we have a high school intern, we have a high school class of business people that come here. All I really want to get across these young people is like, I was an entrepreneur and I was a leader back when I was in middle school and high school. Nobody recognized that and nobody picked me aside. And I was like, I was really rebellious. I was angsty. I fought back on everything because I just wanted to do stuff my own way. I felt like if somebody just let me go and let me be an adult, I could accomplish some pretty great things or die trying. And it manifested itself in a lot of rebellion. I wish somebody like me would have recognized that, pulled me aside and just said, listen, middle school and high school is going to be really tough for you, but this is going to be a superpower in your 20s and 30s. And there's only a few percentage of people who will take things upon themselves, like what you're doing, what I'm doing. It feels weird. You can't find people like you, but they're out there. Your time will come. Just hold tight.
Oh, I love that. That's the perfect note to end on. Thank you so much for that. And I think you've probably struck a chord with a lot of the kids and adults out there. So thank you so much for your time. We appreciate it.
Yeah. Thanks for this opportunity.
You've been listening to Curio from Harbor and Sprout, a place to discover, adventure, and journey together. Explore the Cabinet of Curiosities at www.harbourandsprout.com/pages/curio. We love to hear from our family. Send a message to our social media accounts or get involved around the Curio campsite. See you again soon for more exciting experiences to share together.